Hi, my name is Tracy Morgan, your host for New Books in Psychoanalysis. And today we're welcoming Dr. Erwin Hirsch to our show to interview him about his book, Coasting in the Countertransference, Conflicts of Self-Interest Between Analyst and Patient, published in 2008 by the Analytic Press. Dr. Hirsch lives and works in New York City. He teaches and supervises at five psychoanalytic training programs, including at William Allison White, the Manhattan Institute for Psychoanalysis, and the NYU postdoc program. He serves on four editorial boards and has published over 70 psychoanalytic articles and reviews, as well as presents nationally and internationally at conferences. For this book, he received the Goethe Award in 2010. Coasting in the Countertransference is a book that asks analysts some hard questions about the ways in which our characters may impede an analysis. It's a book that looks at money and the analytic frame. It's a book that investigates preferred ways of relating that an analyst may have and how that can throw an analysis off track. It's a book that has a chapter on baldness. So it does a lot, and we're very happy to have Dr. Hirsch with us. So without further ado, we'd like to welcome Dr. Erwin Hirsch to New Books in Psychoanalysis. Hi, welcome, Dr. Hirsch.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. So welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. You're the second person that we're interviewing, and I guess before we begin, I just want to say that I have a one-person psychoanalytic background, and you have a two-person. So I'm looking forward to learning a lot from you about how you work, and I think our listening audience is going to be is varied from one- and two-person perspectives. And I wanted to begin by asking you about a concept that you develop in your book, Coasting in the Countertransference, Conflicts of Self-Interest Between Analyst and Patient. What do you mean when you say coasting in the countertransference?
Well, fundamentally, countertransference can always be used productively. I have noticed in myself over the years and in all the people I've taught and supervised that very often we don't use our countertransference productively for many, many reasons. Most of those reasons cluster around maintaining a comfortable equilibrium for both parties in the dyad, and the emphasis is on comfortable equilibrium because it's not just comfortable for the patient, it's comfortable for us, the analyst. And it can be comfortable for many, many reasons. For instance, Freud said transference is the heart of psychoanalysis and the hardest part of psychoanalysis, and it is the hardest part of psychoanalysis because patients talk about us, and they talk about us in ways that are often very uncomfortable for us. So if we collude to sort of help the patient not talk about us or not tell us things that are uncomfortable to us, not make observations that will be uncomfortable for us, not notice things about us that we would rather maintain not being noticed. We can create relationships where seemingly productive material is talked about, but very, very important material is avoided. So coasting in the countertransference refers to maintaining a relationship that is comfortable for us as well as patients, and avoiding dealing with crucial matters.
I see. So in a two-person model, the thought that comes to my mind is that the analyst is thinking the patient is talking about something that's really real and really about me, and it can be taken much more personally. Is that the risk? For instance, when the patient says, you know, you're cold or you're withholding, and you maybe really have aspects of yourself that are cold and withholding. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about that can be challenging?
Yes. Anything that casts us in a light that we do not want to be cast. Any perception about us or the way we work or the who we are as people, anything that will make us more uncomfortable than we prefer to be made at any given moment, can easily be avoided.
Sure, there's a lot of motivation to move away from that because it can be very uncomfortable.
You mentioned the two-person model. Let me add something that may be important at this juncture.
Yeah.
In the old days, almost any, when the analyst was conceived of as a blank screen, more or less, and the analyst was conceivably thought to be able to truly be a blank screen, that is to not let his or her subjectivity enter the picture. You know, that is, if we were really well analyzed enough, we could stay out of the mix. We could really control the person of who we are completely, and aided by, you know, being behind the patient on the couch, et cetera. So in that era, what most anything that patients said about us could easily be written off as projections. You know, they have nothing to do with us. You're really talking about your mother, your father. Those are the usual suspects. So if we are unfeeling or cold or disinterested, or our decorations of our office were ugly or in poor taste, or we were ugly or unappealing.
It really wasn't us.
It was mommy or daddy or sibling, usually mommy or daddy. And in an era of two-person psychology where our subjectivity and our personhood cannot be taken out of the equation, comments in this way have to be taken more personally. That is, it doesn't preclude the patients being very influenced by their mommies or their daddies, but it also doesn't preclude their seeing things about us that are quite on target, albeit they may be sensitive, let's say, to coldness because they had a cold daddy. So they're sensitive to my coldness. But it doesn't mean that I'm not being cold with them, or I'm not cold in general. And so if we have to take patients' comments about us as saying perhaps something about us, it's much more threatening, it's much more uncomfortable than being able to write it off as a projection. The whole field has changed in that regard, and transference has become more uncomfortable to address.
Yes, I absolutely felt, because my training is in one person, when a patient talks to me about some aspect of myself, which may be true, I also have some insulation. And I was thinking about in the two-person model that the analyst has to have a different form of insulation to be able to weather those storms, because we all have pockets where we're not analyzed. Many. Mm-hmm. So,
well, even if they are analyzed, it doesn't mean that true. We've changed. I mean,
that's right. It's our character. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, we are flawed human beings, no matter how good our analysis is, and no matter how many years we do it.
That's right. Absolutely. I was wondering, you know, did you have a chance to read this past week, or was it the week before? Do you read New York Magazine? There was a really interesting...
No, I don't read New York Magazine.
Oh, well, you know what? There was just a very interesting piece written by a man who'd been to four different analysts from four different traditions here in New York, and every analyst had fallen asleep on him. And...
Funny, I'm surprised I didn't hear about it.
Yeah, it's quite...
My colleagues or patients. No, I didn't hear about
it's
that.
It's quite an interesting piece in which... the patient goes from analyst to analyst. He goes back and visits his analysts, mm-hmm. and asks, you know, what happened? And I was thinking in your book, you have it's very touching where you talk about, you know, wanting to, and I think Donnell Stern also mentions this, wanting to find out what went wrong. in certain yeah. analyses. So I was wondering what would you say motivated for you the writing of this book? Because I think it's a very unique text in the field. What motivated you to write it?
Well, selfish things primarily. I've written a lot and I think people who write a lot, you know, one motive may be to add to the field, to be useful. However, you know, most people who write for selfish reasons. It's to be noticed, to be seen, to be as a public a figure as possible. It's a form of ambition and wanting to be recognized. I think more a narcissistic thing than altruistic thing. So I pushed myself to write, over 30 years since my kids were starting to get a little bit older and not need my full attention. And so the book is something I hadn't done. I've published many articles, but I've known so many people who've written books and nobody bought the books and they went out of print immediately. And it's so much trouble to write a book and it takes so long and it's so much of a pressured effort, at least for me or for most people. And so I avoided doing that until I was convinced by certain colleagues that no matter how many articles I've written, a book would really enhance my presence in the public domain more than the sum total of all these articles I've written.
Hence, you have this interview.
This interview, indeed. Yes. Precisely. Uh-huh. I don't know if you would have called me to interview me based on my 70-plus articles. You probably would not have.
This is not new articles in psychoanalysis. You're right.
That's right. So, that's what motivated me to write the book. And of course, also I had to write with some idea that was at least new, or no idea is really unique, but you know, unique enough. So, this theme has been evolving, in my writing. That is the significance of the second party, the analyst, in the dyad. It's been evolving, and sort of it evolved to this. Two of the chapters in the book are from articles I've previously written, and six are new. Does that answer?
Sure. Yeah.
Self-interest is what motivated me to write the book.
Well, this prompts me to ask the next question. When I read the book, the word selfish, I didn't count how many times you used it because I'm not very obsessive, but it was really there a lot, mm-hmm. the word selfish. And it did jump out. And I wanted to ask you more about what it is that you mean when you're referring to the analysts being selfish. Can you say more about that, or do you feel you've already described that? I mean,
Selfish and self-interest, I think I used interchangeably, although selfish has a bit of a stronger connotation than self-interest. I think there's a lot of things we do as analysts that are for us more equal to or more than for the patient. This is a 50-minute interview based on the tradition of a 50-minute hour. Well, my hour is 45 minutes, and there are still many people who do 50-minute hours, but probably more people these days do 45-minute hours, and that's selfish, cutting the hour from 50 to 45. Mm-hmm. I write about seeing patients back to back, in clusters of three or four or more. There's absolutely no benefit, just detriment to patients. You know, for us not to take a break. And then that's how the 50 That's how the 50-minute hour was designed. 50 minutes, 10-minute break. I mean, these are simple everyday examples, but that's what I mean. By selfish,
Well, you're in a way talking about the how the market, so to speak, impacts the profession. You know, how the economics, how economics impact how we work and how we go about our work, and not taking breaks to reflect on the patient. You know, if we did that, well, we would see, you know, three fewer patients a day, possibly. And that impacts our making a living, which you really take up in this book. You have two chapters on money, which were very thought-provoking. So I wanted to ask you, how does the need to make a living get in the analyst way of being an analyst?
Oh, my goodness.
I have to ask. You beg the question.
It gets in the analyst way more than any other single issue. There's a very good article that just came out in Contemporary Psychoanalysis by someone named Christopher Bandini, who's a graduate of Manhattan Institute for Psychoanalysis, talking, and he's an MSW, and MSWs often don't write that much in psychoanalytic journals. He's talking about what it was like to enter this profession, go through analytic training, and how damn hard it was to earn a living during and after, and all the compromises he felt he had to make in order to do that. But yes, there are so many compromises. We talk about selfish. You know, as psychoanalysts, we all prefer to see patients at least three times a week. You know, depending what school you come from, it's three times a week, or it's four times a week, or sometimes five times a week, if more classical Freudian. But a tiny, tiny percentage of patients nationally, I don't know about internationally, but nationally, are either willing to or certainly can afford to do that at anywhere near what our normal fee is. The unselfish thing to do would, if somebody can afford, $200 a week for therapy, is to, see them three times a week for, $65 a session or $70 a session. If we really, wanted to do our best work and do what we believe is best, that is multiple times per week. But it's rare that we'll do that. It's certainly rare that I will do that. I talk about I/we. I mean, that's one very, very glaring example. We'll most likely see that person once a week at $200. There are some schools where people are encouraged to come every other week, because then, you could charge $400. But that's a whole, that's an extreme. That's a whole other story. But we, I think, keep people in treatment, as I write about, way too long these days. And that if we had a waiting list of patients, patients would get through this process much more quickly. There's a vested interest to keep people in treatment. There's a longer than is ideal. People are in treatment now if they're willing to stay. That is both people in the field and people outside the field for legions of years. And this was not the case in the 60s and 70s that I hear about, when psychoanalysis was much more popular and there was the laws of supply and demand were more in our favor than they are now.
Freud did not conduct very long analyses, right? Seeing people 6 days a week.
That's right. He didn't. I mean, that was unusual in a different regard. But somewhere in between what he did and what we do would probably be more optimal for the patient population.
Right. You write in one of the chapters on money, how can you try to help patients when an ultimate positive outcome is a loss of income? That our patients get well and they do leave us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and that's always a sort of a shocking moment. You know, eventually they're better and they have to go, and our attachments mm-hmm. to them are attachments to them, and some of those attachments, of course, are also financial.
They're personal attachments and they're financial attachments, and mm-hmm. I think we don't encourage patients, by and large, to leave as efficiently as they would if economics were not an issue.
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking about I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how the need to make a living at the profession might keep the analyst away from, and I think this is really at the heart of your book, keep the analyst away from addressing difficult topics, topics the patient would rather not contend with, issues in character, et cetera, that we shy away from. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I think sometimes we are frightened of patients leaving if they get too angry at us, or if they are cognizant of their anger or their disappointments, if we push them to address some unsavory characteristics or characteristics that they would prefer to remain have split off, more split off. I think we sometimes or all too often get involved in sort of comfortable interchanges where the patient is sort of empathized with and seen more as the victim of a cruel world, cruel mommies and daddies, cruel significant others, and we're on their side. And if to not be on their side, to be more challenging, can make us frightened that the patients will not want to do this, will get angry, will leave. So there's any number of themes that we might avoid, anywhere from patients' observations about us, through dreams or through discussing other people, transference observations that we don't address because we don't want patients to be fully aware of their criticisms of us or their perceptions of our shortcomings, as well as qualities within the patient that the patient is uncomfortable dealing with that might lead them to flee, to bolt, to... So I think that that is another factor that economics has a lot to do with.
Yeah, certainly. I found it very interesting in the book. You have a chapter on sort of theory and what is it? Let me just get the
theory as a form of countertransference.
Yeah, I thought that was really maybe that was well. I don't know if it was my favorite, but I really was engaged by that chapter. And you suggest that it's a theory can be yet another form. And I'm quoting you here: pervasive personal countertransference. And I began to wonder about, the different schools of psychoanalytic thought and training do attract different personalities. I mean, I'm in training at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies, and, I think about who's drawn to that way of working and what kind of people, tend to go there. And I began to wonder who is the sort of the person who's drawn to the two-person model, who's the relational or interpersonal analyst, who are the people who are drawn to those schools as opposed to the more Well, the modern model is not actually strictly classical, but let's say that, you know, the more classical Freudian. Do you have anything to say about that? Because it seems that you're looking at the match between personality, and training.
I don't have anything to say about that aspect of your question, because I can't really typify in that way. That is, I think the theory that we embrace, you know, and based in part on the institute we attend, the supervisors we pick, and probably more important than anything, the analysts that we have, has an enormous impact on our conceptualizations. That is, the way we conceptualize patients and understand patients is sort of inextricably related to the theory that we have embraced, that we've grown up with, and that we've embraced. But I cannot really say that one sort of person is attracted to one kind of theory and another sort of person is attracted to another kind of theory. I mean, I write about it as a function of two things, basically. Mm-hmm. One, identification with our analyst. It's an artifact of, I think it's to some degree an artifact of who we wind up with. Certainly for me it was. I mean, I was in analysis with someone from the White Institute. I identified with the interpersonal tradition. I was basically happy with my analyst, and so when I went for analytic training, you know, I could supervise us from that point of view, and that became my psychoanalytic identification. I write that if I had been referred to a classical Freudian analyst, and he or she, if it worked well, it probably would have been somewhat of a liberal classical Freudian analyst. I'm totally convinced I would have identified with the Freudian perspective, gone in that direction myself. The other factor is the aesthetic, and I don't know that that's a personality issue. That is, there are certain things that I read, and that even way back when I started training, that I would read that I just would not resonate with. That would put me to sleep. You know, and I feel somewhat embarrassed confessing this, but my wife and I always have a joke because her psychoanalytic sentiments are close to my own, that if we had trouble sleeping and we pick up some Freud, sure, we would have no trouble going to sleep. And I could say if we picked up some Klein or if we picked up some Lacan. And that's been the case way back, you know, in my 20s. I couldn't get into it. It put me, when I read the interpersonal literature, it resonated more with me. And I don't know that that's a personality thing, because, you know, some people like science fiction, other people like mysteries, other people like, you know, Shakespeare, other people like postmodern fiction. And I don't know that you could typify personality. You know, some people like rock and roll, some people like classical music. I don't know if you can typify, you know, what type of person likes. So it's really an aesthetic as much as anything else. And that's kind of a long-winded answer, but anyway, that's my answer.
I appreciate your talking about that, because it just came to my mind. I was thinking about, you know, people who. I would say people who are at a modern institute tend to be really interested in, you know, working constructively with aggression. And there are people who may have conflicts with aggression, and then through many years of an analysis, usually a modern analysis, work through their conflicts with aggression so that it can be, like, you know, put to good use and be more fun. than destructive. And I was thinking about friends of mine who have trained at different institutes or are drawn to different schools. And I think a lot about where we overlap in our conflicts and where we where we don't. So that was an interesting aspect of your book.
I see that less as an artifact of personality than an artifact of the analyst we wind up with. And I say wind up with because it's often not necessarily based on personality. It's based on referral and who referred you. If you're in analysis with someone from a modern institute who deals a lot with aggression and your analysis is effective and you're pleased with it, you're likely to identify with that analyst, and that is going to become your way of working and become your school, if you will.
Yes.
Years later, that might change, and I know many people for whom that has happened. There are a number of interpersonally trained, or I know that have become very interested in Klein and Beyond.
Right.
Years after their analysis
we age and we find ourselves drawn to different schools of thought. Absolutely. I wanted to tell you something. As I read the book, I had a thought, which was, gee, I really want him to write another book. And the other book I wanted you to write, because I feel it's sort of embedded in this text, is a book about the straight male analyst and the straight male patient. I thought you have a lot to say about working, being a man, working with men. I found it very, moving, and I thought you have a lot of depth. And I'm wondering, would you consider heading in that direction? Because you really do give a lot of incredible case examples about the straight male analyst, straight male patient duo that I really hadn't encountered a lot of writing on the topic. Could you say anything about that?
Well,
do you have any thoughts?
Well, thank you. First,
sure.
Thank you for your compliment. I had written a few articles on that subject. One article called Men's Preference for Men, which sounds like it has to do with sexuality and homosexuality, but it really had to do with heterosexual men often being much more comfortable with other men.
Like your patient Alan, who you write about, who I think wanted to, he was wondering if men, if a straight man could marry a straight man, that it would be kind of a, a good marriage of sorts.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And I often found in working with men, particularly men who share a number of interests, certainly an interest including sports, which is a big interest of mine.
I hear you like baseball.
and more.
You're a Mets fan, I hear.
And football and basketball. The relationships we get into with patients in long treatments, I mean, there are so many people I have seen who I wished I could be friends with, that I wish that when the treatment stops, the relationship wouldn't stop, that's true in relation to some women. And so of course there are plenty of relationships with women who I wished, if it were not for the boundary of the relationship, could have been sexual.
But
with many men, the relationship sort of took the shape in many respects of friendships I've had. Friendships I've had since childhood, and I have some friends who I've been friends with since childhood, or friendships I have that I've made later in life. The relationship takes on that form of a friendship. There's a sense of comfort and familiarity and shared interests that lead to a very, very strong closeness, a closeness minus any conscious sexuality. And so I've written about that that phenomenon, the sort of comfort of finding people who share a lot of similarities.
And you wouldn't, you wouldn't challenge a friend, right? You wouldn't bring up something to a friend about their personality that you noticed was sort of potentially problematic, right? So you can have a patient who you feel such enjoyment with, and yet you can blind yourself. Is that what you're saying, to sort of aspects of their character that they came into analysis to work on, right?
Right. Yeah. That would be the coasting part. You know, the good news would be some sense of comfort and the freedom that comfort brings. Yet on the other hand, one can sort of be friends, you know, and stay in that comfort and not make the relationship analytic enough or challenging enough. It would be analogous to seeing a woman who I find attractive, and the relationship could stay sort of boy-girl flirtation because it's so enjoyable, and not deal with some of the other, you either not make that sufficiently public in the analysis or not deal with some of the more unsavory characteristics because of enjoying the flirtation or the mutual attraction. So much.
Right. Yeah, no, I
see the analogy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm thinking of, female patients that I work with who like clothing or cooking or,
right.
And there is something that's very appealing. But I often wonder, okay, is the patient, hoping to, is this, I would wonder, is this an induced feeling? Am I being lulled away and does the patient want me to stay away from what might be more, more troubling? And let me ask the question in this way. I was wondering, how is the idea of coasting in the countertransference different from what some might consider, and I think I might consider, the more traditional idea of the countertransference resistance, where the analyst objects to having certain feelings that are induced or produced by the patient or by the treatment dyad. Is there a difference between coasting and a countertransference resistance?
Well, with coasting, there's the implication that there is at least some consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The resistance is more the implication that the experience is not conscious, and that we don't know. You know if I'm this person revisiting this poor analyst who fell asleep.
Yeah.
It's inconceivable that those analysts did not know. They were bored or disinterested, but yet they didn't sufficiently address their boredom and disinterest. And
before they went to sleep, right?
there was a consciousness.
Yes.
And in these patients with whom I feel very friendly, and I enjoy, talking about this sport or that sport or last night's game that I know they watched and I watched, that isn't unconscious. I know there's an awareness that I'm doing this and not that it's all bad to do.
Right.
I don't believe it is. But to stay there or to stay too much there or to stay too much in boredom and drowsiness, there is an element or too much into flirtatiousness or titillation or being idealized, another nice feeling for sure.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain consciousness. So the term resistance usually implies more of a lack of consciousness.
I see.
So,
I see. Yeah. So it's like you've come out of, you've had your supervision session on the patient, you know, and yet it's, we don't take the more, unnerving step. I think you gave a great example of a woman you supervised who, was, I believe, very sort of sympathetic and maternal and believed this is what the patient needed. And this was also in her character, in the analyst character. This is what the way she was comfortable being. And the patient didn't do too well. And she knew and she couldn't or wouldn't, however you want to put it, bring up the issues that would bring her into discomfort, into an uncomfortable place. Yeah, sure. I understand that. So here's the question. How do you think the analysts need, we talk about the analysts need to make a living. And I was wondering about the analysts need to be loved. And how does that impact the analysis? Because I think in part pushing away our patients' disappointment or anger or upset with us is more about our need to be comfortable, but also a need to feel that we're lovable, possibly. Do you have thoughts about that? But the analysts need to be loved.
Well, loved or admired, I think. I did see different theories would dictate what it is that's lovable. That is, if being just. To use a certain extreme, there's a theory that emphasizes empathy. Now, of course, if we have no empathy, we can't even do this work. Obviously, empathy is very important, but there's a theory that places empathy in even a more central role, or that empathy is pretty much all we should be doing. And one can, for instance, adopt that theory, and you know, it's a theory that has a lot of logic and a lot of consistency, and one can certainly argue for the value of employing it. But the motive for embracing that theory could be more than the sense that theory makes. It could be that it's the more likely road to be loved and admired by a patient. But however you take the opposite, you know, you mentioned the theory of dealing with aggression, you know, on the surface that looks sort of more intrepid, you know, the analyst who actively goes after aggression and all those, the more darker side of of patients. If we embrace that, we could just as well feel that the road to being loved is to unmask the patient's aggression, that the patient will love us more, not necessarily being empathic, but in uncovering their aggression, which will then free them and liberate them and leave them to feel like they've really, really in treatment with a brave and intrepid and, you know, someone comfortable with aggression. Mm-hmm. So I think we all want to be loved and admired, but being that way, we do different things to get that. That is what we believe is therapeutic gold is different. We differ in what we believe is therapeutic gold, empathy versus aggression, for instance.
Right.
And we can't take out of the equation the wish to be admired with whatever.
Either way.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I'm not... I don't think I was clear enough in what I was saying.
No, but. I think it's very clear. I mean, yeah. I had not conceived of it that way, but I do think you've clarified that, Right. The wish, whatever you want to be admired for, the capacity to, you know, to tolerate and to, you know, work with aggression, for instance, that might be your, you know, what makes you feel that you're good and you're great and you're loved or whatever. Right. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, just take two other almost stereotypes, but extreme. Let's say the analyst who is much more interactive, says a lot more, perhaps is more open about revealing personal things, is warmer. I mean, you could see where that could be motivated by theory, but it could also be motivated by, you know, the wish to be loved, to be a nice guy or a warm person, or not one of those cold, depriving analysts.
Right.
But let's take a depriving analyst, you know, the prototype of the traditional Freudian analyst. Well, that analyst could be striving to be admired because they are so good at being depriving, that is, they are so good at self-control,
yes,
that they are so good at not intruding their person, that they're so good at trying to be objective, that they're so good at trying to maintain a difficult and pristine relationship, that they don't at being non-indulgent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think whatever we do, we can't rule out that it's partly motivated by the wish to be loved or admired.
I was thinking especially the analyst with a big personality who works and is very quiet and containing and listening, and there's a lot of quiet in the room. That person needs to feel appreciated for how much they hold back, for instance.
Yes. And,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Right, and their supervisors or their peers or their colleagues will appreciate, you know, how this gregarious person is able to be, you know, sacrifice his or her gregariousness for the greater good.
That's right.
The patient, and isn't that a wonderful characteristic?
Yeah. Right. How do they do it? You know, it's like weightlifting or something. How do they bench press all that? You know, how do they manage their character and still be as quiet as you get the sense maybe that they're being? You know, we haven't talked about, and we're going to be out of time soon, but I wanted to make sure to touch on this. You have a chapter in this book on baldness,
mm-hmm,
and on being bald, and working with patients who are bald. And when I came upon it in the book, I said, "What is this doing here? What is this? This is so interesting." It sort of jumped out at me, and I wanted to ask you, what made you decide to include a chapter in the book on this topic?
Well, when I was considering it, I'm sort of technologically deficient, but I asked someone, you know, some technological person to search, you know, do a thorough search of the literature from forever.
Yes.
And there's no literature.
Right.
There is no literature.
I looked on the PEP also. I was really interested. I was like, wow.
No literature on the subject.
Yeah.
And as a man who is now bald and, you know, was gradually balding slowly from the 30s onward, I know the impact that had on me. It was a very big part. I was quite troubled by it. And I have had many patients, not everybody, everybody's different, but so many men are troubled by it, and there's no literature on it, and the subject is very often avoided in the analytic process. That is the degree that it can be troublesome for so many men.
Mm-hmm.
So. And I've avoided it myself because of my own shared discomfort, mm-hmm, within myself, and sort of empathizing with how delicate an issue it could be,
right,
for for so many men.
So that's really that's an example of coasting, because you have an awareness.
Yes, it's an awareness. Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
it's glaring. Yeah. It's right there. We're not talking mm-hmm. about it. I know we're not talking about it. I don't want to bring it up. The patient doesn't want to bring it up. Mm-hmm. Should it be brought up? How to do it? Yeah, that I think mm-hmm. that's a good example. So then the chapter does serve as it is it is exemplary, or it does look at a model and a way of working, and does elucidate your thinking on coasting. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a very sort of courageous and I really appreciated that you'd written it. I mean, I'm a woman and a female analyst, but I do have bald patients who are balding, and my patients lie down and I'm seeing the backs of their heads, and
and they may feel very humiliated or uncomfortable having a woman looking at their weakness, if you will.
Absolutely. So is there anything that we have about a minute or so left? Is there anything that you wanted to say that we haven't gotten to? I'm sure maybe plenty of things, but.
First, my appreciation to be asked to do this interview. My great fear in writing this book is that, that it would go out of print very quickly and no one would read it. And my efforts would be wasted, but the book has done reasonably well, and this interview is an example of it. So, mm-hmm. I wrote it to be recognized, and this is an example of being recognized. And I'm grateful for you for this recognition. The only other thing is, I think it's we didn't talk much about the sort of the character or the personality of the analyst and the kinds of relationships that we as people are comfortable
yep.
Getting into, and that can never be discounted, that some of us are more comfortable in relationships where we are very nurturing and we create dependency, and others of us are more comfortable in relationships where there's elements of flirtation and playfulness, and other of us are more comfortable in relationships that are sort of testy and challenging and confronting and aggressive. Independent of the patient, what we are more comfortable with does have an impact, and it's an under examined element in our field. That is what we bring to our relationships with our patients.
And that would be my one person background, not knowing exactly how to work with with those ideas yet, I think. Mm-hmm. So that would be reflective of in part what you're talking about, because those are ideas that I'm familiarizing myself with, but I'm not familiar with them on a lived level in my own analysis and mm-hmm. my supervision and my training. So there we have, I think, an example of what you're talking about. We didn't take that up because it's not something that, that feels comfortable to me. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's an area of the interviewer's discomfort.
So. Okay. It's an excellent example, right?
Yes. Absolutely. We're demonstrating.
The medium is the message.
That's right. So you have succeeded. I have a countertransference resistance, and it's now 51 minutes. It's almost 52 minutes into the 50-minute hour. But we're going to sign off. I want to thank Dr. Erwin Hirsch for being with us in New Books in Psychoanalysis, discussing his book Coasting and the Countertransference. I've enjoyed speaking with you. I've learned a lot. And write another book. I'll interview you again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.